Welcome back to Dev Dive, everyone, a conversational podcast. I am one of your hosts, Stephen Fontana, and with me, as always, he's my brethren from another Metheran. I use the same one twice because this is take two because I screwed up the audio. What's up, Andy? How are you?
No one needs to know that.
Yeah, but it's better.
No one knew
it's
about
better.
Us.
It's better it's that raw. They know it's, because it's raw. It's authentic, yeah. And it shows that we are just as indie as the games we cover. You know what I mean?
Nice.
How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, man. Should I redo my spiel again?
Absolutely. Tell us the story, please.
We
tell
can
us
say the story this time. I'll say it worse.
Yeah, if you can, just say it terribly this time.
Terribly. I'll say it worse than the first time.
Worser.
So here's a little background, a little BTS of the show.
Okay.
So most of the time when I reach out to guests or prospective guests to be on the show, it's always a resounding yes. Yay, awesome.
Resound.
Yeah, promote my shit. Yeah. I'll be on your show. I'll be there, no problem. But sometimes people do their homework. And they ask for stuff. Like, can I see your links? Like, what do you guys do? What are you all about? And then I get the, oh shit, we're fucked moment. Because they're gonna know that we're just a pair of mutants doing the show. And they're going to run to the hills. But fortunately, this week's guest did not run to the hills. He checked us out. And apparently, we're pretty good.
We passed the vibe test.
Well, yeah, we passed the vibe test.
That's pretty dope. Yeah. Speaking of our guest on this week's dive, we welcome Eldar Basic, studio director of Monster Theater Games and developer of Atomic Owl, a synthwave pixel art roguelike that pays homage to games like Mega Man X, Shovel Knight, and Dead Cells. Eldar, welcome to the show.
Like I said before the audio crapped out, I am excited to be here. When Andy sent me the links, the reason I asked for that was I just wanted to make sure, you know, because you never know. You never know. Like sometimes you walk into something that is a little bit different than the vibes you guys have. I checked out your Twitter. I checked out your Patreon. I was like, okay, these guys are legit. Pretty sure they know a thing or two about video games. That's why I'm here. It's, you know, to talk about Atomic Owl, but it's also, I like talking about video games just in general. And, you know, what inspires me, what inspired you guys to talk about video games with dual screens and Indie Rift. And yeah, I'm just excited to be here. It's cool. It's cool.
Just you wait. There's so many games we're going to talk about.
You see, that's why we save Rapid Fire for the end of the show, because if people are checking out the show, our guests usually don't make it to the end of the interview before they realize when the shit hits the fan. So that's how we get you in.
That's when true exactly regret sets in.
I don't exactly know what's coming, but my goal with you guys is to figure out just how dorky you dudes are.
Oh boy.
There is a reason why you guys may be,
you know, but are you Dark Cloud 2 Coaster? Dark Cloud 2 Coaster, Final Fantasy 10 Coaster.
Oh man, those are dope.
But I'm definitely Dark Cloud.
Yes.
Wait.
One copy of the disc. With the book and everything.
Which could be a coaster if he tries hard enough.
This is like the worst internet moment of all time.
It's my favorite game of all time.
Yeah, but you know, so there's Dark Cloud. Wait, really? It's your favorite game?
My favorite game of all time, yes. Dark Cloud. Yeah.
Holy shit, dude. Check these guys out.
Dark Cloud, man.
Wait, hold on.
Oh, look at you.
Japanese versions, man.
So you're an Uber fan. I am just I want to own the game that I sold to GameStop again because it's like my favorite game.
I'm not even on camera. For whatever reason, Dark Cloud 2 and 1, they're like $10 on eBay Japanese. They're not even rare.
Oh, what the
hell? So I was just like, yeah, sure. I'll pick that. This was years ago. But anyway, cool, dude. Okay.
Wait. All of my dope shit is not in here, but I have a play date.
We got the crank.
That's dope.
The crank.
It's so cute.
Is that the crank? No, that's not the crank, is it?
It's a crank, yeah.
It is? Oh, crank's the crank. Right? Oh, I remember it being a different color.
That's cool. I always thought it was yellow.
The Kickstarter one, yeah.
It is yellow. Okay. You just had the slip. See, for those audio listeners, Andy has a slipcase that is a navy blue.
It's purple.
It's purple. It's the lighting.
The
Pokemon logo colors.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Dev Dive, a conversational podcast where we dive deep into the world of indie game development and uncover the stories behind the games and the people who make the games that We love the show posts each and every week. This is our second week of this version of the show, but of course we have about 100 other interviews under the Dual Screens podcast, and even before that, Nintendo Dual Screens podcast. But we're Indie Rift now, so go to indierift.com for all of your indie gaming needs. And of course, in just a few days, we are going to be launching a brand new Patreon. We're scrubbing the old one completely from existence. We're launching a brand new one, so you could support us over there. Just go to IndieRift.com/Patreon. That should forward you right to the Patreon page as soon as it's launched. Right now, it is not public, I don't think, Andy, but it should be by the 1st. That is our goal there. So let's just dive right into it then. We'll do our dev dive, our first dive, our swan dive of the show. And Eldar, why don't you tell us what Atomic Owl is?
Sure. Atomic Owl is a 2D side-scrolling action-packed roguelite that features a shinobi owl as the protagonist. And his goal is basically to save his brainwashed friends in a 8 to 10 hour indie game dev experience. The idea for Atomic Owl started or arrived, so to speak, like back when I was about 5 years old. My dad came home with a copy of Mickey Mania on Sega Genesis that he bought from a pawn shop. Now, to go back even further, this is about, you know, 5 or 6 months after my parents and I landed in America. We're from the ravages of Bosnia and Herzegovina. I was born there, and then shortly after I was born there, a war broke out. So for about 3 years when I was a baby, I was kind of stuck in this like war-torn region until, you know, my mom and dad got us out. We landed in Dallas, Texas, and started living there. It was cool. And then, yeah, just one day, my dad came home with this, like, box, which I still have. It's over there.
Sega Genesis. The box?
No, oh, sorry. I called it a box. Yeah, that'd be okay. Cool. No, I don't have the original, like, Sega Genesis. It's a Sega Genesis 2. And he came home with this thing, and at first, like, my little five-year-old brain was like, is this, like, a VHS thing? Because we had a VHS in the house. And I was like, oh, is this like for watching movies? And he's like, I don't even think he understood what he had. He was probably just like, this is for kids. Bring this home to your kid. I don't even know how much he paid for it. Anyway, brought home Mickey Mania. And I still have the Sega Genesis 2 and the Mickey Mania from back then. And I popped it in and I didn't even understand what was happening. I was holding this controller, which, all of this was a new sensation, right? And then, you know, Mickey Mania loads up. It goes through the start thing. I kind of understood start menus because of the VHS stuff. And I was like, okay, cool. Not a movie. Started playing Mickey Mania. It was like the void turned on. I was just like, what? I'm playing something. This is amazing. And I don't know. Like a lot of kids, you know, they're interested in adulthood with what they were first exposed to or took a really early interest on when they were children. And I'm just a shining example of that. Like I played a side-scrolling action, you know, sort of like jumping platformer, and it was brutal. It was hard. That game has the worst hitboxes of all time. True. I don't know if you guys ever played it.
Accurate.
It's like notorious for having the worst hitboxes ever. And it wasn't until I got it on my, my Retroid Pocket, where I could do save states, that I actually beat that freaking game.
It sounds so familiar.
Yeah. Okay, so like, okay, there's, let's say there's, I think there's like 7, 8 unique levels in that game. First 7 are fine. Like, you can get through those. They do something with the 8th one, where it's just like a 30-minute stretch with 3 lives, and you just can't, you guys know, you get it. Anyway.
It's what we call the Battletoads effect. At a certain point, the game is just, you're fucked. And you
crazy
it's
fight.
Impossible. You can't crazy, do it without a save state.
Crazy difficulty spikes.
I wonder from a development perspective if that was for, because this was like before the advent of like trading back in your games. Like that wasn't really a thing, but game rentals were. And I know that a lot of the time, the smaller mom and pop shops, they would give, at least the one near me, I remember it was like they would give percentages to the publishers of the games based on how many they were able to rent. But like a Blockbuster, they would just pay an exorbitant amount per copy of the game and like just try and make up their money. But I wonder if there was like a deal made between like Blockbuster and Hollywood Video to be like, hey, make sure these kids have to keep renting this game you know, to finish it. And, you know, they don't let him finish it in 3 days. And like, I feel like that, like, drove the industry in, like, 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, around that time.
Well, one of my favorite podcast developers turned podcasters, David Jaffe. And, you know, he was the director on the publishing side of Mickey Mania. And when he's not talking about God of War, he spends like 2% of his time talking about that game. And he, I don't remember if he mentioned whether it was because of returns or whether it was because of sales in general. But basically, since he worked on the publishing side, he said that the developers of that game artificially made it more difficult, so to pad the timing, sort of similar to what they did with Lion King on Genesis, and I think it was either just Genesis or NES or one of those. But yeah, they back then, I mean, they didn't need to make those games any harder than they were, but they did so that people probably didn't return them, and they didn't, you know. You know, it kept them. It kept the kids playing, so to speak.
But Mom, yeah. I didn't finish it yet. Okay, I'll spend the extra $8.
It's like arcade games. They were hard, so you can spend more money at the arcade.
Right? Yeah, drop the quarters.
And there was no quarters. How are you going to spend more time in the game? Well, you still got to make it more difficult. And that's how you
get the attention span. So it wasn't, you know... I think I've seen, like, a lot of kids, like my nephew, for example, right? He played a game, and it, you know, in some instances, depending on what game you're exposed to, the train doesn't keep rolling, right? You know, you cap out at maybe, like, nowadays, I see a lot of kids that play Fortnite and Minecraft, and they don't really explore too much outside of the realm of, like, what's in the top 10. That's not, like, a sports game or GTA. But back after I played Mickey Mania, it was just hit after hit after hit. I mean, it was the golden age, man. It was Mickey Mania, which is not a game anyone talks about. But then shortly after that, Sonic the Hedgehog. Shortly after that, Sonic the Hedgehog 2. Oh, the N64 is out. Ocarina of Time. Majora's Mask. It was just hit after hit after hit. So for my entire childhood, and I mean, I think this is a pretty common story. But we were really lucky to have the games that we did. I mean, it was game after game after game. And whether it was Sonic the Hedgehog, whether it was Killer Instinct, whether it was Donkey Kong Country, I mean, it just kept coming. There was no shortage of, like, amazing experiences. And after what seems to be like a decade of just playing really good games in the late 90s, Final Fantasy VII came out, Final Fantasy VIII, got into the JRPGs, basically just started playing everything I could get my hands on, except sports games. I mean, that wasn't really my thing. I had a lot of friends that were into NBA Jam and, like, NHL. Wasn't really super good at those because
you're my soulmate. You get it.
It's between you guys. Well, was the Dark Cloud stuff on camera? Because if it is.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's on camera.
Oh, it is.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's okay.
Okay, cool. Cool. I feel like. And then they started their own Dark Cloud podcast. Anyway, 6 viewers a year. No one talks about that. So, yeah, just never, you know, was it Nintendo or was it Sega? That never stopped playing. What was that?
I don't know.
Oh, like the slogan?
Yeah.
The slogan.
Never stop playing.
Wherever I heard that, I was that, like, one. Okay, I won't.
You got a point there. Agency.
The big one, for whatever reason, and it's not even like the Mega Man that people talk about, but it was Mega Man X5.
Uh-oh.
I was over at my cousin's house, and he had it on PS1, and I played it, and I was like, this is awesome, because it was edgy. It was like kind of like that game opens up and it's very like a somber tone. And then you jump in and your ex and like, I think like Zero is defeated or something like that. And there's like a sense of apocalypse to that game. And it just really drew me in. And it all goes back to Atomic Owl, because Atomic Owl is also inspired a lot from like edgy PS1 sort of like side scrollers and like, you know, that type of like 90s, that grit, you know, like Super Sharks and like grittier, like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle stuff. And so like the idea, I think, was born there. Like when I think back, I'm just like, you know, because when you're a kid and, you know, you're not a gifted programmer at the age of like 12 or 11, like a lot of, you know, solo developers are, like Jonathan Blow, you know, you sit there and you're like, man, I'd love to make a game. And then you start thinking of them and so on and so forth, the idea starts culminating, and next thing you know, it was like, fast forward a few years, I started working in the transportation sector, and it was brutal, and I started that when I was like maybe like 21 to like 26, 27, And my career in games, I actually owe it entirely to my wife. Because whenever we first started dating, she was working at a studio called Playful in McKinney, Texas. And they made two games of note. I think they're working on another one, but I think the two big games that they made were Creativerse, which was sort of like an open world, sort of like Portal Knights slash Minecraft type of deal. Mm-hmm. But they made Super Lucky's Tale, a new Super Lucky's Tale on Nintendo Switch.
Yeah.
And I was just like I was dating my wife, but also I was just like, I can't believe you work in games. Like, I can't believe that's a real thing. And she's like, you can do it too. And I was like, no, I can't. And she was like, yes, you can. And slowly but surely, you know, with her help, I was able to get a foothold in Gearbox Studios in Frisco, Texas, where I was a playtester for Borderlands 3. And man, that was like, I've never stepped foot in the game studio before then. But as soon as I walked in that bad boy, I was just like, man, this is insane. They had the statues of like Borderlands 2 characters, and they had like free snacks and coffee. And they had I don't know if they still have this, but they had a Dungeons and Dragons room, but it was like a secret room because it was just like a little, it was like a baby closet door, and you would go in there and it was just like this immaculately designed, like wooden, like fireplace lit room where they just play Dungeons and Dragons. And I was like, I can't believe this office exists, because you have to consider where I was at the time. I was in like dingy, like transportation, like trucking offices. Like, I was just like blown away. And so I play tested Borderlands 3, and I'll never forget the first time they, like, because what they would do is you would play for like a week, and then you'd come in Monday, and they would basically give you something and say, rate this, and then tell us how it compares to our game. And I remember the first week, they had us play for a few days, and they were like, compare this UI to our UI. Tell us what's better about this UI compared to the Borderlands 3 UI. And the UI they chose was Dark Souls 2, its inventory UI, which is possibly like the worst thing to parse if you don't know anything about that game. That game is using crazy statistics and crazy stats and just like the weirdest UI of all time. And I just remember just sitting there just laughing, because I was like, why am I looking at the Dark Souls 2 inventory here? Because I remember playing that game and I was like, man, I really should have paid more attention to Dark Souls 2. It was cool. Talking quite a bit. not super used to this.
Right. I'm loving all of this, by the way.
So you kind of got a peek.
Stop me a little.
You got a peek behind the curtain, and you got bit by the game dev bug. And you how did it go from playtesting Borderlands 3 and, you know, basically shooting bad guys for probably I would assume months on end, if not a year or more. How did you go from that to, oh, I want to be a director and make my own game?
I want to make the thing.
Well, that part's kind of okay. So I feel like for all the bad stuff that happened during COVID, there's a few graces, right? It introduced remote work, it introduced the ability for, you know, us to be talking like this in many ways. Like, that time period opened up the avenue for remote collaboration. And, you know, it was during a trip to Arkansas, actually. And it's really weird and tough to explain, but, you know, I was on a canoe. This sounds like a fever dream whenever I explain that out loud.
This feels like something out of
automatically
like,
my favorite story.
I was on a canoe. It feels like it's out of Wayne's World. Like, just
no,
like...
It's, no, dude, I was on a canoe. It was sunset. It was golden. It was gorgeous. Well, actually, no, my wife and I were both on canoes. We were there with her family. And
separate canoes?
They were all... Yeah.
Oh, so you weren't canoodling.
She was on a canoe off to the side. Well, because, like, what she did is she would go, like, way out. And I would stay near the shore, which personality stuff, I guess. But I would, like, stay near the shore, and I was just kicking back. And there was this, you know, it's kind of like a little lake, and there was this like big old tree sort of like right in front of me. And at the top, I don't know if it was like the time or whatever. There was a freaking owl there holding like in its talons. It was holding a stick. And then when it flew it away, it kind of whipped the stick somehow. And I was like, did that owl just like use the stick as a weapon? And then I went back into like the Airbnb, And I started playing this game called Steel Assault, which is a little Nintendo Switch indie game. It's like beautiful pixel art. And I was just like, man, it would be really interesting if I made something like this, like a pixel art 2D side scroller. And then my nephew came in. He's like, what is that? And I showed him, I was like, Steel Assault. And he was like, that looks so cool. I was like, yeah, dude, it's not all just Fortnite. Like, there's some real pieces of art out there. And I swear to God, he was just like, you should make something like that. And I was like, I don't know. I don't know how to do this. And he was like, just do it. And I was like, you are a really wizened, like, 6-year-old. But then, like, the idea kind of stuck with me. And I was just like, I mean, is it like terribly hard to make like a Sonic style game? Like, is it terribly hard to make like a side scrolling game? Yes, it is. I will answer that right now. It's very hard. But then I was just like, man, what is the character? And then the character of the owl, like Hidalgo, just popped into my brain. And then the game started like forming. And I was just like, man, what if there was this, what if there's an owl and he uses like a sword and then the talking sword? I'll tell you where the idea for the talking sword came from. I don't know if you guys have seen it, like in our trailer or whatever. There's a talking sword. Have you guys ever seen Afro Samurai?
Oh, hell
Kind
yeah.
of an older one. There's Afro, and then there's the talking, like annoying dude that's played by the guy, and he's like a ninja. And he's like always in his ear. I've always loved that character. I don't know why. I've always loved that sort of dynamic. The straight guy with like the comic character really. That's where that idea
I was
came
gonna
from.
say, if you were gonna say the talking sword fee from Skyward Sword,
No.
I would have ended the call immediately.
But like it all just, I was just like, there's I have this idea for like this like shinobi owl. And then I Googled it. I was like, has anyone done this before? And then, once you get an idea and then you kind of validate the fact that like no one's done it before, because there's Owl Boy, but not exactly, that's not the same
Totally
thing.
different kind of game,
Totally
though.
different vibe. Totally different vibe. You're comparing like Mega Man X to like Braid. There's different
Yeah.
vibes. And then I was like, okay, nobody's done it. And nobody's paired them with like a chatting talking sword. And then the Mega Man X5 influence came in. You guys know about the Mega Man bosses. Every
So
single
wait,
one has one.
I was gonna ask you before, but you were like on a roll, like talking
Okay.
wise.
Yeah.
Your game better have like Guns N' Roses themed bosses again, or you're off the show. 'Cause are there?
They're not
Is it?
necessarily, no. They're not. Well, they're so like our bosses are directly inspired by Mega Man's bosses, where there's like, there's we have like four main bosses, and they all have like different elements, and they one has like a purple scythe, and one I guess they're also Shovel Knight inspired, but they're very tonally different. They all use various elements, and you go through the stages, and it's like, this is the fire one, this is the lightning one. Like that's kind of like the approach we're giving to our bosses and stuff like that. But the idea just it just grew and grew and grew, and to the point where I was like, I'd like to maybe make a design document out of this. So, 3 days straight, just designing the game, just like, what do I want our levels to be? Is this just a regular side scroller, or is there a twist with this? Is it maybe it's like a roguelite, and it became one. But what do our bosses look like? What do our characters look like? Slowly but surely, working with our artists, we just sort of came up with a theme that we think is sort of our own. Like it came in waves, right? There's like the background of our city, which is like a cyberpunk bird city, which is to, I think it's like fairly unique. And then there's the characters, and they're like Japanese inspired samurai and shinobi, but they're birds as well. And like the main bad guy is like, he's like an evil crow sorcerer, and just bits of it just comes to you, comes to you, comes to you. And I for me, my ideas always come at night, right before I'm about to fall asleep. And so I always keep my phone, and I always just like write it down before I lose it, because there's been times where like I'll lose something. And just over the course of a few months, the story came to play, the characters sort of solidified. And every time my artists were annoyed, because I was always like, hey, this is cool, can we make like this character? And he's like, I think we can do something like that. And then we do some concepting, and we went back and forth, and now we have our main characters and like the bad guy, and like our NPCs are also birds, and but they're not really warriors. They're more like, one's like a bat and stuff like that. And so, but at the same time, what I always would tell what I always tell my what I always told my artists was, I want to keep the whole weirdness to it. You know, I don't want the game to be overly cute. I kind of want it to be weird. I want to use like off palette colors, like these like strange blues and like off purples. And I feel like, you know, by doing that, by not using primary colors, the game has sort of created its own art style. And, you know, we just, I feel like we're not copying anybody's look. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of games that copy looks. I'm not going to name drop them. There's a lot of games where I'm just like, that's literally just a copy of that game. And I see it all the time. And I just didn't want Atomic Owl to do that. And I suppose
can,
the other,
I, can
the other
I
thing,
ask why? Like, why is it important to you that unique in look? Like, gameplay is gameplay is another thing. Obviously, you're going to take, you're going to pull, you know, homage, you're going to pull influences from other games. Why was it important for you to not pull so many influences from other mediums, from a physical, a artistic direction?
Two words, Hollow Knight. The reason that that game became so big was because, I mean, in my opinion, that game's fine to play, but I think there are games that play better than Hollow Knight that are Metroidvanias.
Okay.
But that game's look is uncontested. It's dark, it's gummy, it's bugs. Nothing looks like Hollow Knight except what copies Hollow Knight. Nothing looked like Hollow Knight before. That game has an art style that was 100% unique to the artist that made it. And I personally believe that when it comes to succeeding in art, and with my studio, we're all outsiders, you know, like, sure, I started in Borderlands, you know, whatever, but, you know, a lot of people that I've talked to, they've been in the games industry since they were in college, you know, since they were in high school. Like, they knew what they knew that they were going to do that. And for me, I got into it late. And so I've always kind of considered myself an outsider to the games industry because, A, I got into it late. And at the same time, you know, I didn't have the traditional education for games. You know, I went into transportation. I'm doing something that is completely outside of what I thought I was going to do. It's what I've always wanted to do, but I never thought I would be able to do it. But anyway, so yeah, back to games like Hollow Knight, you know. And the reason I say Hollow Knight instead of Shovel Knight, I feel like Shovel Knight borrows from the NES palette, maybe like the SNES palette, in ways where I think that, you know, like, it does unique things, but you've kind of seen it before. But I think artistic individuality and artistic being the first to do something that is popular, but being the first to also do something that's completely unique is, I think, potentially the secret. I mean, Atomic Owl hasn't succeeded yet, but if it does, I'll chalk it up in great part to its art style.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the success, because you do have a Kickstarter, and your Kickstarter is
a success.
Like, you did it. It's not, you know, to say it's not successful is, you know, that's not genuine. Like, you had a $35,000 goal, you're over 1,000 backers, you're $55,000 raised. So from, without even having something, you know, in people's hands, you have a successful Kickstarter campaign. So why don't you tell us a little bit about starting up on that? For, yes, congratulations. And
sure. Thank you.
Talk a little bit about the Kickstarter campaign and what that success is going to lead, or you're hoping that success is going to lead to for Atomic Owl.
Well, for starters, that $35,000 goal is the bare minimum that we needed to finish the game. We put about the same amount from personal funds into the game for about the last like year and a half to get it to where it is. But we hit a point where we're just like, hey, you know, we need that last 35, 40 to really finish the game. Now, Kickstarters, I think, are two things. One, they're marketing for the game as well. Like, you can grow a community just by funding a game on Kickstarter, which is what we wanted to do. But at the same time, it's the ultimate test of how your product will appear to gamers, to consumers. I mean, you can have all of the, you can have ads running in the back, you can have a giant subscriber list, you can have huge social media. I mean, generally speaking, if you have a huge social media, you'll get it funded. But we have like 200 followers on Twitter. I mean, we just announced our game a month before the Kickstarter happened. We could not be newer to not only the games industry, but to the overall Kickstarter community. And so a lot of what we were doing, it was make it or break it. We were just like in a position where we thought, okay, people either like this thing or they don't. It's either they like the look of our characters in game or it fails. And so a few nail-biting moments into the Kickstarter, we're just like, how are people going to react to this? And we went live, and it was so cool, man. Like, I just saw, like, on my phone, because you get Kickstarter notifications, we just had like, oh, in the first minute, we had like a wall of green notifications where I had to like scroll a few times, and I was like, this is not happening. This is crazy. And I think coming from a place of honesty with our art, I think, it's just, I just want to convey how genuine the game just is, because we don't want to do microtransactions. We don't want to do battle passes. We don't want to do paid skins, DLC, anything like that, which is, and I'll touch on this later. It's why we partnered with premium edition games. Very important. But I think our message of just like, hey, we're just trying to create like a fun 8 to 10 hour sort of experience for you guys. Because I feel like, games like Hollow Knight, Shovel Knight, Dead Cells, in my opinion, those are like the cream of the crop when it comes to indie games. And I always wanted to join the ranks of those types of games, like Evil Empire and a Yacht Club. I mean, hearing stories about them like 10 years ago, whenever they achieved success, that was also like an inspiration of mine for making like the type of game that I'm making now. Kickstarter, though, Kickstarters are nerve-wracking. I mean, you spend two, maybe like a month and a half just getting everything prepared, getting the story ready, figuring out exactly what your budget is. And then you just send it off. And the weird part is the emotional hangover that comes after it, because everything that we've been working on, the characters, the story, the idea of the game, I mean, you're putting it on the table for people to decide whether they like it or not. And for literally a no-name studio that popped up in February, like, we're just in that lucky place where people were like, yeah, this is cool. We like this game. And I was like, well, thank God, because that would have been real embarrassing if it did not go that way.
That must be nice. It's like you're a brand new indie game studio. This is your first big project, and already you're getting a resounding, return from an audience. It's like we saw this, we like this, we want more of this. Please make this.
It's literally all you need as like an artist or like a creator of something that's not, that's entertainment. That's the lifeblood. That's the crystal. I mean, it's perfect. And I hope it doesn't go away. I mean, that's the other thing. It's like, oh man, I hope this doesn't go away. But then when the game comes out, people are playing the demo for Steam Next Fest, when the game actually finally does come out, when people, I mean, we're doing a lot of work on it right now, but pretty soon this week, people are going to, we're giving, for everyone that purchased it, we're giving them the entire soundtrack. That will hold people over for a little bit. Then the Steam Next Fest demo comes out, people finally play the game. I think it's also really challenging to market and, potentially sell an idea without having people play it. That's the other thing that I think is really impressive about our Kickstarter. Nobody's played our game. They just like how it looks, the potential of it. And I think that's great. And I think when people play it, because I think what we focused on so much was the game feel. Like, that's one of my founding principles in design, is game feel. You know when a game feels good from like minute one. You just know. The run, the verticality of the jump, the verticality of the dash, getting hit and being stun locked for too long. Like, we tore all the bad stuff that feels bad about games. We took that out. We just scrapped it. And we just wanted to create buttery smooth 60 frame jumping and movement and just feeling really good. Like, another game that we've been compared to, but we haven't actively compared it to ourselves, is Katana Zero. People on Instagram have been like,
Oh.
this looks like Katana Zero. And I'm like, you said it. But yes, that game also feels super good. Just feels really crunchy and crispy to play. And
And goddamn
yeah,
that soundtrack of that game. That
that
is
soundtrack is
whew.
amazing. That soundtrack is amazing. We
So
hope our soundtrack, we hope people like our soundtrack too. But I cut you off. Sorry.
no, I was gonna ask you, well, two things. First of all,
Yeah.
can I slacker back? Because I want to get that soundtrack. As possible.
If you want it digitally, it'll be on Steam this week. If you want
Hell
the
yeah.
vinyl, I think you missed your window, because
That's all
we,
right. Ah,
yeah.
crap. And
Yeah,
the
but
second thing I want to ask you was,
yeah.
you mentioned before about the importance of the look, how it's not like it's copying anything. It's its own unique artistic style. How does that then lead into the gameplay? How does the gameplay feel not lifted, not copied, but original and unique and its own thing compared to all the other like scores of side-scrolly roguelike games that are out and about?
Sure. So, with our gameplay, we've taken a lot of inspiration from other games. Where what we've done there is we've drawn inspiration from other games. in the sense of we took what was good in games like Dead Cells and copied it over. We took what was good in Shovel Knight and copied it over. We took what was good in Hollow Knight and copied it over. The death system in Hollow Knight is in our game, and it feels not too crazy, not too difficult. The Shovel Knight bounce off of enemies, we put that in our game. But what makes our game, I think, unique is we and you'll see it when you play it. We do a combination of melee attacks that seamlessly blend into range attacks. So what you'll do is we've placed our enemies in such a way where if you are adept at mixing up the way you approach, you know, your melee attacks with your range attacks, you can attack, throw, and it sort of chains into this like sort of unique way that I haven't seen before in indie games. And it creates this, it's sort of like our time stoppage. When it, like Katana Zero has that time stoppage feel. Mm-hmm. We blend melee attacks and like range attacks in a way that just feels really good. We're also mixing up the roguelike genre a little bit. So in a lot of roguelites, what happens is you play through the whole game, and if you die 75% of the way through, you start at the beginning of the game. That's the only thing I disagreed with in Dead Cells and a lot of these popular roguelikes that came out back in 2017 to like 2020. What we do is we've basically created a roguelike Sonic the Hedgehog system. And you're probably like, what is that? Our game.
Yeah, does... what is that?
So our roguelike system is, we have zones, very much, very similar to how Sonic the Hedgehog is. But instead of dying and going all the way back to the first zone in the game, you go back to the first act in that zone. So it would be like if, you know, in Sonic the Hedgehog, you lose all your lives, you retain your progress from the previous run, and you retain that in the first level, rather than going all the way back to the start of the game. Mm-hmm. So it's player friendly, but also you keep the drops that enemies have dropped. So the enemies in our game, they drop power-ups, but they're dynamic power-ups where, like, if an enemy drops an electric wing remnant, is what they're called, then you can use that wing remnant for the remainder of the act. But then in the next act, they're gone. However, you still retain your blade wing level, which is basically 1 to level 99. And as you progress through the game, you basically retain that level. So you can make it halfway through the game, and you're still at blade wing level 50. That's permanent. That never goes away. And it allows, you know, sort of different items to drop as you get further in the game. But the cool thing that, you know, I'm very curious to how players are going to react to this. Something happens halfway through the game that resets all progress. And you play as...
Oh, fuck you.
Well, I'm not going to... It resets all progress, but you retain something really cool. And I wish I could talk about it, but basically we have a twist in the game that I think is going to be the talking point of it. Like, not just narratively, but something happens and then you play as somebody else.
Oh, where someone's going like, to die. Someone's dying.
Can't wait for you guys to see that part.
And it's just Metal Gear Solitude.
I already got like happening. Heartbreak.
Well, in Metal Gear Solid 2, you only play as Snake for 3 hours out of like the whole game.
Uh-huh.
So
right.
And if that was a little bit more.
Are we gonna play as the Atomic Owl for an hour and a half?
No.
But I didn't play as the bat.
Rat guy.
I promise the twist is really I think it's really cool.
No spoilers. There's a twist. Nope. That's great. That's all you need to know.
You already said too much.
You've said too much.
I said that there was a twist in our Discord, so it's public, but
okay.
It's cool. I think it'll be really interesting for players.
But it's always fun when the game's design is influenced a little bit, or more so, I guess, more than a little bit, by a narrative choice. Like, this seems like the narrative choice was kind of a 50-50 reasoning behind kind of changing what happens and like to the player, because... How do you avoid that not coming off as just a cheap way to like restart the player? You know what I mean? Does that make
sure.
sense?
Sure. Well, yeah, absolutely. I think the player would feel a little bit ripped off if whenever they did this sort of narrative shift, if they felt weaker. But in our game, you're not going to feel weaker. There's something that happens. There's something that you acquire that's a brand new feature in the game. It's a brand new mechanic where you're like, oh, that was cool what I did in the first half, but this is cool too. I like this. So It's one of those, like, you know, yeah, this part of your adventure is over, but here's this entirely new way to experience the game and kind of go through things. And it's not just a platforming thing. It's not just a combat thing. It's you introduce something that's really fun. And you know, one thing that we've also kind of grappled with is like, well, is only the second half of the game fun? And I'm like, I don't think so, because what you lose whenever you go into that second half, you gain something new. But the first half of the game is still the core gameplay experience, you know? So I think that sort of like traditional roguelike problem of I'm dead, now I feel like I've literally made no progress. I mean, you have in games like Dead Cells and like Slay the Spire. Mm-hmm. But when you restart from the very beginning and you're like, oh, I have to do all of this over again?
It's a momentum thing. It's totally a momentum thing. Yeah.
It, in my opinion, it kills momentum. And we wanted to just avoid that. We want to keep some interesting aspects of the roguelite structure, but get rid of the ones that I think are defeatist for the player.
Why do it at all? Why do the roguelite thing at all? If, like, it seems like you have a grasp on storytelling and the narrative that you want to tell. Why is the roguelite element, gameplay-wise, why is that integral to the story you're trying to tell?
Well, for the gameplay part of it, when we were doing some playtesting on the roguelike system, we discovered that with the way we have it structured, with the power-ups that you get in each act, mm-hmm. there is sort of, it is fun to re-experience those in every act going forward. So instead of just keeping the same stuff that you have in every, like, that's the good part of roguelikes, in my opinion, is just not, is going to the next place and seeing like, oh, what are the enemies going to drop now? Like that part, I was like, okay, this is a good part of the secret formula of roguelites, is seeing and anticipating what enemies are going to drop and knowing that once I'm done with this section, once I'm done with this act, in the next act, I'm going to have this entirely new experience. But if I die, I'm not going to have to play the act I just played. I'm just going to have this whole new experience where, you know, the game Atomic Owl gave me this lightning build with this dual sword setup in this mission. In the next mission, I might have like a wind hammer. And I think there's a lot of fun there going from act to act, where each act, you don't know how it's going to be. And every player is going to go through, like, let's say they're going to go through the forest section, and they'll do like the broadsword. And then some players will be like, well, I had the whip. And for that part, I think that part is just really fun. So but then it resets. I think the resetting part is the key sort of, you know, what keeps it fun, what keeps it dynamic, and what keeps it different every single act, but not erasing too much progress. So meeting the player in the middle, so to speak.
Is there a narrative reason why it resets, like a game like Returnal, for example? Like, she's aware that she's stuck in this loop. When she dies, she keeps, you know, being resurrected, and she can't break out of this loop. Is there a similar concept in Atomic Owl where you know why you keep getting revived after you die, like as part of the plot?
Hats off to Returnal. I played that game. I thought it was really difficult. What they figured out with the coming back system, it was genius. Ours leans more into the classic, you know, this is just sort of what happens mm-hmm. in video games whenever you die. But you know, what we've done similarly to something like Dead Cells is whenever you do come back, let's say, you'll get a little quip from the main character and the talking sword, like, oh, that was bad, or oh, we really got beat up there. So you know, we keep it the game, it's not, I wouldn't say it's a very seriously toned game, mainly because half of the characters are fairly comic reliefy, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't take itself far too seriously. Sort of similarly to, you know, like I think Hollow Knight takes itself very seriously. I mean, arguably, you know, the design of the enemies and the design of the characters is very like chubby. Everyone's like chubby and sort of cute in a weird way, but then they all spurt this like orange blood, but then the narrative is really like Dark Souls-y and serious. Ours is kind of light tone, and we break the fourth wall quite a bit. And so I don't know if you guys have played it, but our tone is very similar to something like Neon White, which is a game.
Neon White is really good.
Yeah. We get a lot of narrative sort of tone inspirations from Neon White in particular. That sort of cheekiness, sort of like, you know, there's like moments of drama, but there's a lot of humor as well. And a lot of it comes from the sword too. He's always like analoging on everything. So
yeah, I get like Hades from that kind of a vibe where it's like kind of silly.
Yeah.
Why you know you're literally in hell and that you keep repeating because you keep dying and you can't really die in a sense. So that's why you keep going back over and over again.
You know, it wouldn't be too hard to basically just write because the sword is very mystical. Like it helps a doggo out in very, you know, sort of spiritual ways. It wouldn't, I mean, maybe this is where we rewrite this into the script, I suppose, but it wouldn't be too terribly difficult to just, you know, put in some quip about how the sword just like teleports him out of there whenever he's about to die or something like that. Kind of cool. Maybe we'll do that. It's interesting.
Look, we're influencing game design, Steve.
We're doing it. We did it. Wouldn't be the first time.
Good ideas are good ideas. I mean, you know.
Speaking of good ideas, now is the best idea because it's time to slip into rapid fire.
This
is where we get to know you, Eldar.
All right.
Which camera?
Both. Let's do it. Pointing to both cameras.
Right. I don't know what rapid fire is, but I'll play along.
It's very simple. What is the best topping on pizza?
Jalapenos, Italian sausage, and mushrooms.
That was three.
Yes.
Okay.
It was. It was three.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
What's the worst topping?
Pineapple?
It's anchovies. Come on.
Anchovies.
You can. Dude. He's Greek. He's Greek over there. They put weird shit on their pizza.
Oh, no. Feta.
Oh, I love feta. Oh, my God.
You like putting cheese on cheese?
Yeah.
I don't even like feta as it is, let alone
pizza.
Oh,
my God. Asiago.
Yeah, Parmesan.
My God. All right, Andy, you're up.
Who is the best Mega Man X boss?
Oh my God.
Just whatever comes to the quickest one to your brain. It's a lot of them, you know.
Yes, my favorite one is Bass.
Oh.
Yep.
Interesting choice.
You thought I was gonna throw an animal at you. No.
I really thought you were gonna be like
the whale. Or
I thought you were gonna say like fucking magma dragoon or some shit like that.
Bass. Awesome.
The whale. That's Duff McWhalen, sir.
Duff McWhalen. Yeah. No. Bass.
Bass is the shit.
Or no, it's Sigma.
Sigma. I mean, come on. No contest.
I mean, he's probably like, yeah. Like really, like the best one.
He became like a
couple of nerds. Game, you're a couple of nerds, where you are.
I never played past X7. I know it got turn based, like near the end of the X series, but never really played past
X7. X7 is a hot pile of trash.
That's what I heard too. That's what I heard. I'll see it on emulation sites.
No,
I'm just like, I don't know. I don't think I should.
Steve,
keep it going.
Eldar, you got. The Mega Man Blaster. You got it on your arm. Which arm are you putting it on?
Oh, that's interesting. I'm right-handed, so the right one makes more sense. Like, I feel like I could better aim.
Uh-huh.
If you had asked me a year ago,
How are you signing for your mortgage?
I'm a millennial, sir.
How are you signing those checks to buy your yacht with all your atomic owl money?
Can I ask you this question?
Yeah, I gotta ask me what.
Do you think? Okay. Do you think Mega Man could? Do you think he could like slide that down?
No.
And use a hand?
I don't.
No? You think
But here's the thing.
Totally. Yeah. He has another hand.
Yeah. I mean, that's great.
He's like pressing a thing.
But for this question, you don't, because you're not a robot. You get it? You're not a cyborg. Only your hand is being turned into Mega Man Cannon.
My wife and I talked about this.
You're Barrett.
You were
Final Fantasy
exactly.
That's
exactly.
You are.
Exactly.
My wife and I talked about this, and I remember when we first started dating, I told her.
Wow. Okay.
I was like, I would very willingly cut off my arm if it means I get like a cool cyberpunk arm.
Yeah.
That I can like take wires out of my wrist and plug it into shit.
Yeah.
And like hack into stuff.
Hell yeah.
I would very easily have done that. I've been adamant about that since I was like a teenager. I'd be like, I would do that no problem. Hands down.
Hands off.
And when we first started, she's like, I would never do that. Now she totally would. I don't want to change the limbs. But she's just like, yeah, I would totally do that now. And I'm like,
would you get the Tesla chip put in your hand so you could open your Tesla car?
I want nothing. I want nothing to do.
I got a good one.
There are people that have done it, and it is
fine. I know that dude that played Civ, amazing. In a way, and yeah, shout out. Anyway, what you got, Andy?
I'm loving the Mega Man questions. I'm gonna keep it going.
Okay.
Mega Man has bested you in combat. What weapon is he getting?
Oh, that's awesome!
Right,
dude, that's really cool.
You got the what? You got the you got. What what's he getting? What's he getting? Yeah, splash screen is all like dramatic pose.
I have the answer. It's two-parter,
right?
Oh, when
you think of that, what colors? What's the color palette? Also,
oh no, I got you. No worries. Okay. I got the perfect answer. I just don't want you to think too into it because it's not gonna mean anything other than like I think this is a cool weapon.
Sure.
I drop an electrified noose. Think about it. That's a cool weapon. I've never seen that type of weapon before.
Yeah.
I drop a lasso. Okay. But it's
a slip knot. Gotcha.
An electrified slip knot. Anyway, it was on the cutting room floor of an atomic owl weapon. We decided it was a little bit too dark, but it's here. It exists in this form on this podcast. Electrified noose. Super cool. Dude, think about it. I guess it is a lasso because, like, I guess Mega Man, the way he would use it is he would, like, lasso it onto, like, a robot and then electrify him, right? And the color palette, blue and yellow. Or, like, maybe, like, blue and purple. You know? Yeah. The colors of death.
You know what would be cool is, like, if a robot enemy is, like, flying and you lasso it while it's flying, it stays stasis and you could swing off of it using the lasso.
See? That's cool.
That's pretty freaking dope.
That's indie game stuff right there. That's it. So cool.
There it is.
That's so cool.
There it is right there. Let's see. Let's do a couple more here.
Give me some more video game ones. I love the video game.
Video game. Okay.
Give me video game ones.
If you could take the Mega Man franchise.
Oh my God. Mega Man.
Hang on.
Get these guys.
Make your own Mega Man game. But it has to be in a game genre that Mega Man has not been before.
Uh-huh.
What genre are you making? We've had some weird Mega Man shit. We've had card games. I'm pretty sure there was a soccer game.
There was a soccer game. There was a kart racing game. Uh-huh. There was a fighting game.
Was there a first-person shooter-y game? I guess there was, right? I guess it's Legends? No, it was third-person.
No, that was it's a third-person RPG.
Yeah.
Okay. I got a couple, and I'm trying not to just go funny for the sake of funny, but Mega Man Bullet Hell would be sick. I don't know
how. Oh.
Hell yeah.
Give me whatever that is. I mean, he's literally just like, you do a top-down Mega Man game, and he's just
that'd
like,
be fun. That would be fun.
Makes sense? And Mega Man Wave Racing. That's the funny one. But no, Mega Man Bullet Hell would be cool.
I have a weird one that I think would fit well with Mega Man. Mega Man dating sim game where you're kind of...
You dating the robots?
You're not dating them as much as you're like trying to make them happy so that they're not evil robot masters. You know, like...
It's giving...
Coffee Talk or whatever that game is. Yeah, Coffee Talk. Kind of like that.
It's giving Sonic the Hedgehog. The Murder of Sonic the Hedgehog. Have you guys played that?
I didn't play it. I think Andy it's like didn't that. Play it.
Yeah.
I think you did. But yes, it's kind of like that. Exactly
it's
that.
Kind of like that. It's, you know, that I don't know. That game was free, like, as an April Fool's joke, like, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's like a visual novel crime thriller on a train. And I'm like, why does this exist? That game has great music, though. But anyway, more to the point of this Mega Man dating sim. I think Andy was kind of on the right track. I think you should just date all... You should just, like, date 8 Mega Man bosses.
Yeah.
They all have, like, weird quirks. And they're all, like...
Yeah.
And, like, they all get vulnerable on you and weird.
Yeah, like, yeah, what would Iceman like in a date? What would you do for a Gutsman to show him a nice time? Like, learn about their interests and why, you know, why are they bad and, you know, all the other stuff.
You humanize them. I think that would actually be, I think that'd be kind of a hit. You just don't want to do that with Sonic.
Rapid fire has gone off the rails because now I'm intrigued. What are the 8 robot masters that we're going on dates with?
There's too many, Steve.
Let's get 8 of them. You said Guts.
Too many.
Is Cutman in there? Is Cutman making it? He's just
a scissor. Cutman's in there.
You got to throw some garbage ones in there to make them, you know, not as garbage anymore.
Okay.
You know? Like what was it? Like Charge Man? He's like a train. If you're like the front of a train. Any Mega Man 5 boss, put them in there. Because they're all trash.
Is there a trash man?
There's a junk man.
Junk man, there you go. Junk man's junk in man. There. A what a horrible date that would be.
There's two. There's two. I have to throw two in there. One, Iceman. Because, you know, classic. He's icy. He's ice cold. You know, you know. And he's then, small, it's cute. A dating. I'll be honest. It's a dating sim. So, you gotta do Woodman.
Honestly, the jokes write themselves.
Throwing in Hard Man while we're at it, Top Man, the list goes on and on.
Oh God, that is truly. This will go on HIO and
Needle Man. Not, I mean, we're
not.
Listen, if you need writers, we got you, man.
Ring Man.
I suspect that this game will not have the best rating.
Does it have to? Does it have to?
Oh, I didn't mean gameplay wise. I meant.
I get it. Andy, take us home with the final question of the show.
The final?
Yeah.
I hate the final question.
Well, I did the last one, so you got
to do it. I just want to say that Mega Man game ideas, genres, a Metroidvania Mega Man game would be slick.
Yeah, I almost said that. Nice. It would make sense because, like, you know, you the power ups, the progression,
right?
It does make sense. I mean, it makes more sense than like a tile based like card thing. Yeah.
What's gonna happen, Eldar? Is I'm gonna knock on your door one day and be like, "Here's $20,000 in cash. Can you make my Mega Man game?"
Not with $20,000.
Here's $50,000.
Let's think about this. $20,000, then you do your little Kickstarter. You get another $60,000. Yeah, I think we can make.
I want it just for me.
No then it could work. Oh, just for you?
I'll make it for me.
I'll do it for just, five.
Oh shit!
There you go.
Oh shit!
Private it's design. Not going to be the quality that you want.
That's all right. All right, okay. Cool. Last question. I hate this question so much.
Since when do you hate this question? This question's it's tradition.
It's tradition.
Everyone's been asked this, I assume.
It is
tradition.
It's a simple question, yet at the same time, the most complicated question you'd be asked in your entire life. No pressure.
That's crazy.
The last question is, it's a choice.
It's not as serious as I think it's going to be. Okay.
It's a choice. And the choice is Andy or Steve.
Oh, that's what?
You see?
That's fucked. Crazy.
It's a simple question.
I'm not doing that.
A baby can answer that question.
Oh, yeah. I gotta give Steve's holding Dark Cloud.
He's literally holding.
I don't know what you're saying.
He had it from the get-go. There was no way around it.
He locked it in. It was easy. I kind of have a chip. Get out of jail free card there. But
you really did. Actually, you lucked out.
Yeah, I lucked out. I don't. That's crazy. But Steve, in Dark Cloud. Mm. What did you think of the appropriately named Demon Shaft at the end of that game? Do you remember that?
Yes. So the first and only time I actually completed that game was when it first came out. And every time I've restarted it, you know, I fall in love all over again, but I never actually like get to the end. It's just like one of those things I just started over again.
Yeah. Just experience it. I get it.
Yeah. But like, I just, it was a part of my life where I realized games didn't have to be just like a beginning, middle and end. It could have like this, these other game mechanics built into the action RPG. Like I loved the town building and like all of that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the dungeon crawling aspect of it. I just love that it brought like these different genre together. And that was the first time I really experienced that in that way. So it's just, it just holds a very special place in my heart. It's like whenever we talk about our favorite games, Dark Cloud is always on there. And I just want a Dark Cloud 3. Like, just make it, just do it.
Why not? I know, dude. It sucks because Level 5 went on to do White Knight Chronicles, and then
that was
Professor Layton, and I was like, no, they're done with it. But hey, you know, Rogue Galaxy. If you haven't played it yet, it's basically Dark Cloud 3.
It's on the PS2. It's on the PSN store, Steve.
It's on the PSN. Yeah, yeah, the rare, whatever reason. That's on PSN. Game.
Very underrated PS2 game. Rogue Galaxy.
Perhaps. That, my friends, is going to bring us to the end of the show. This was an absolute blast. I had a great time.
The time just flew right by. It's like, is it 10 o'clock? Is it midnight? Who knows at this point? I don't know anymore.
Yeah, it's almost 9:30 here on the Eastern Seaboard. We did a thing.
It was fun, dudes.
Yeah, that was a great show. If you want to follow us on social media, we're at Indie Rift, pretty much on everything. I'm at Batchild 27, I think, on Twitter. I forget. It's been a long time since I told anyone where to follow me on Twitter. It doesn't matter. You'll find me somewhere. Andy's at Pants Guy. Eldar, where can everybody find you, Atomic Owl, and all the other fun stuff?
On Twitter, we're Monster Theater X and Wishlist Atomic Owl on Steam. Just type in Atomic Owl and wishlist that bad boy.
And you also have a Patreon.
We launched a Patreon
literally today. And we're just gonna let that ride, and just whoever wants to, you know, be a patron and donate like $2 or whatever, feel free. Easy peasy.
And that is patreon.com/monstertheater. So go there. You have very affordable tiers and all that stuff. You could support the development and the team. So that'd be great. Thank you, Eldar. Thank you so much for joining us. It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, viewers and listeners. And as always, please be excellent to each other.